This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we have a roundtable discussion of aviation topics from the news and from our listeners. They include the effects on airlines and airports of the U.S. immigration ban, how regulations like third-class medical reform are impacted by new executive orders, bad news for Santa Monica Airport, American Airlines passes on in-seat screens, another airline is grounded by computer problems, clarity on ADS-B for non-electric aircraft, a review of the F-35C and the FA-18 Super Hornet, also glass cockpit versus round gauges, the 2017 Aerospace Media Awards, a warm airline story from Alaska, exploding airline tires, and the global supertanker 747 in action. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 437 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me first is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and man about military aviation.
Good afternoon, evening, or all the ships at sea. Hi, everyone. Looking forward to a good show tonight.
Also joining us is our associate producer, Brian Coleman.
Hey, Max. And everyone out there in listener land.
Very good. 2 weeks in a row, Brian. That's pretty good.
I know. It's amazing.
Absolutely. Also with us is Rob Mark. He's the senior editor at Flying Magazine, a flight instructor and publisher of the Jetwine blog. Hey, Rob.
Oh, sorry. I was... You caught me humming. I didn't really mean to do that. Sorry. Good evening to all the folks around the world and ships at sea.
Hey, Rob, I just read since the last episode, your article in Flying Magazine about the Eclipse 550. Great article.
Thank you. That was a lot of fun to go. Somebody says, hey, I've got this jet. You want to go play for a day? And I went, oh, let me think about that. Okay. So,
yeah.
And Max T has a type in the Eclipse, so he knows what that jet is like. And It was really a fun airplane to fly. I liked it.
Fantastic. Yeah, it was interesting to hear how the new 550 compared to the original 500 that you flew all those years ago, and how it kind of left you with a different sort of feel for the aircraft.
Absolutely.
That was
interesting. Just hope they get to the new Eclipse. But you know, that's another story. They're having a few coughs along the way.
All right. Well, we'll be following along. It's sort of an exciting airplane. It kind of goes back to the beginnings of Airplane Geeks, or I think it was maybe the Eclipse was the first aircraft that we actually talked about way back in the beginning in 2008. But we're not here to reminisce. Let's also introduce the other Max Trescott, Max West. He's also a CFI. He's an author and a glass cockpit expert. Hey, Max.
Anchors away, my boys. Oh, we have the ships at sea theme tonight. I don't know. Yeah, and Rob, the 550 is a whole lot of fun. Does that kind of feel like taking a Cirrus around the pattern, except in a jet?
Yes. Piece of cake to fly once you get used to it.
Yeah, it is a one cool, fun little jet. So glad you had fun.
I just thought I'd mention in between here, since the board is lighting up, I promise everyone I will not sing ever again.
me too, by the way.
Good. Thank you, gentlemen. All right. Well, this episode, we're going to focus on the week's aviation news and also topics from you, the listeners. So we actually have a really packed agenda here, and I think we better get started. So let's dive into the aviation news from the past week. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Yeah.
Ready from the marina.
All right. Well, if you've been listening to us for more than a little while, you know that anytime we get into politics, we get into trouble. And I suspect that we'll be in a lot of trouble this episode because there's a lot of stories that are impossible to ignore, and they have aviation connections. So we'll start out with the Reuters story in Yahoo News. This is how Trump's abrupt immigration ban sowed confusion at airports and agencies. Now, for those of you maybe who are outside the United States and aren't following along in all the fun of the new administration, on January 27, President Trump signed an executive order. And it really, I guess, fulfills one of his campaign promises for immigration policy. And the order restricts immigration from 7 predominantly Muslim countries. It shuts off refugee admission for 120 days. It bans admission of Syrian refugees until further notice. Well, over the weekend, there was a lot of confusion. Were green card holders affected? What about people with dual citizenship? Even airline crews seem impacted. And there were many stories in the press about specific people having trouble reentering the United States. And some of these stories were kind of heartbreaking. And we also saw a number of demonstrations at many airports by people who were opposed to the executive order. So with that background and the hope that we don't go down the politics rabbit hole, let's talk about the impact on aviation. What did you guys see from the events of the weekend?
Well, you summarized that really well, I think. Yeah, I mean, I guess the airport lobbies were quite a bit more crowded with folks protesting, and it's just a surprisingly large number of airports. I saw a report that even Birmingham, Alabama had 3,000 people protesting the terminal. I mean, that's not kind of the typical place that you might expect that. But yeah, all the airports here in the Bay Area had a lot of protesters, over 1,000, you know, at San Francisco International and some in downtown San Jose. So I guess it made it a little bit more difficult to get in and out of the airport. And, of course, it made it incredibly difficult for folks that were detained for, you know, 8 hours or more as their status was being determined.
So, MaxT, up in the Bay Area, were the protesters out on the street like they were at LAX, or were they actually inside the terminal building?
Yeah, it depends where you are. They were in the building. They were in the international terminal at San Francisco International on the first day. On the second day, which it was Sunday, if I'm recalling this correctly, they were on the street in downtown San Jose. I don't know that there were any at the San Jose airport. I know there were some in Oakland, and I don't know whether that was in the terminal or outside.
Yeah, the reason why I was asking is they were actually on the street. You know, there's the horseshoe at LAX for all 8 of the terminal buildings. And they closed down the airport for significant periods of time. So
wow.
Flight operations were, well, maybe flight operations weren't affected, but passengers getting to and from their aircraft definitely were. And it was a big disruption down here in L.A.
Yeah, to my knowledge, everybody was able to get to and, you know, through the terminal. They weren't really blocking, you know, access to the airport, which is good. You know, if you're going to protest and make your point, don't inconvenience other people.
I think one of the issues that many have raised is that the airlines, the airports, even the TSA, immigration officials really didn't have any advance notice, and there wasn't any advance conversation about what the order, whether it was coming and when it was coming and what it would include, which is kind of unlike the situation I think we would normally find, where there would be a much more consultation with the different government agencies impacted, as well as the private sector that was impacted. But that didn't happen here. So there were, there was a lot of confusion at the airports, and people just weren't completely certain exactly what the rules were and how to react to them.
Well, you know what? Go back to the last year prior to the election, and you know the difference that we saw between the way discussions were handled from the Democratic side and the Republican side. And Donald Trump was pretty famous for just kind of tossing cherry bombs into places. And he did promise he was going to shake things up. He was going to drain the swamp. He was going to do things differently than everybody else. And now that it is Gee, I think it's only the end of the first week. I guess what we should probably be taking away from this is that this is kind of the way things are going to happen, I think. And the fact that it wasn't apparently thought through too well, they don't really seem to be too majorly concerned about that, although they did tweak it just a little bit to make sure that it was clear that the people with certain kinds of credentials, like green cards and that sort of thing, were able to get back into the United States okay.
Yeah, I think a lot of times before something gets rolled out, new order or regulation, there's a lot of consultation among agencies to work out the kinks ahead of time. So when a new program is rolled out, yeah, it's kind of smooth. And here things were treated inconsistently. You had people who were in exactly the same situation who were treated differently. You know, some people from the same country with the same green card were put back on an airplane to the country they came, whereas other people in the same situation were allowed into the country. And, you know, if you're going to do something, fine, but let's try and treat everybody consistently.
Yeah, Max T, I completely agree with you. The issue that I have with this whole thing is the administration says, yeah, we processed, a couple hundred thousand people just fine. It was only 1% that was affected. Well, if you're that 1%, that's a big deal. And for this not well thought out policy to affect all of these people, my heart really goes out to them.
Yeah, I read that there were some, 88-year-old grandparents who were detained. One guy was blind and the wife was suffering from something. It's like, oh, man.
Yeah, you just don't want to hear that.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, I think we pretty much agree here. You know, they can set policy, but come on, let's do it well. Let's not have chaos when you implement new policy.
Well, when you talk about aviation, of course, you talk about regulations. And the new administration is also taking some steps with regard to regulation that could impact aviation. In fact, I guess there was an executive order, another one signed just today as we record this, concerning reducing regulations, controlling costs, with the idea that for every new regulation, regulators have to find two regulations to eliminate.
That's so what does that mean?
That seems to be the name of the game.
So if the FAA wants to propose a new FAR, they got to get rid of two of them?
Well, you know, this is like the immigration thing. It's not really very clearly spelled out. Conceptually, yes, we're going to cut regulations by dumping two for every new one you want, which is supposedly going to make people think twice about trying to impose new regulations. But how that's going to work out, is it, you know, a regulation with, does one regulation that only has 100 words in it count when a new one that had 10,000 words in it came in? They didn't really explain that.
Yeah, yeah. And this can have an impact on, well, some regulations that we've been talking about. For example, third-class medical reform. We see an article over at EAA. This is titled Regulations on Hold, EAA Monitoring Impact on Medical Reform. And what they talk about here is, the mechanism by which new regulations and policies become effective in the United States is their publication in what's called the Federal Register. You can kind of think of it as like a big book. And if the regulation isn't yet published in the big book, the Federal Register, then it doesn't exist yet, really. So the Trump administration has ordered that no new regulations be published in the Federal Register, but also that regulations that have been issued but not yet taken effect, like third-class medical reform, are pushed out 60 days. So that not only could affect
Part 23 rewrite as well.
Right, exactly. Both of those. And so I think the EAA isn't, as well as everyone else, isn't really clear on what, if any, is the impact.
Yeah. So I guess on the medical, we May 1st, I believe, was the implementation date. So now it means that the new basic med, you know, may not come into effect until sometime in July instead of May 1.
The
maybe.
Yeah. Exactly.
Maybe. The EAA Vice President of Advocacy and Safety, that's Sean Elliott, he's quoted in this article. He says, such a freeze is not unprecedented when a new administration and party enters the White House, and it's intended to allow time to review regulations issued under a previous administration. He says, often the freeze is lifted after a short period to review, or after a short period of review to allow the workings of government to continue. Says that could very well occur well before the May 1st effective date for the third-class medical regulation, but only time will tell.
Well, that's true. I mean, we have always seen that we're a new administration, and this makes sense. They want to get they really want to get a handle on what it is that they're getting behind. But they've added that new element to it, which is the, oh, by the way, if you bring this one in, you got to get rid of some of the other ones. That's a new one.
That's a new one. All right. So very confusing in many respects. But let's move on to an item that we've talked about on the Santa Monica Airport. And the FAA has agreed to allow the city of Santa Monica to close the Santa Monica Airport as early as 2028. And Max T, also, isn't there something about shortening the runway?
Yeah, so everybody really was just totally shocked this weekend, not the least the Santa Monica Airport Association, when the FAA had a closed-door meeting with the airport officials and announced an agreement to allow the airport to close in 11 years and to allow the runway to be shortened immediately. Currently, I think it's around 5,000 feet. They're going to shorten it to 3,500 feet, and I'm sure the idea is keep the jets out. So everyone is really kind of shocked. I saw one journalist talk about the FAA having caved on this. I think everybody thought the FAA was going to fight the case, and instead they basically agreed to go ahead and let them close the airport. So quite shocking.
Because normally, don't we think of the FAA as being an advocate for small airports?
Yes. and I don't think we really understand, you know, why the FAA either figured that they didn't have a leg to stand on in court, which most of us thought that they did, or why they thought that this was a reasonable, thing to do. As I recall, the airport was transferred, from the government to the city of Santa Monica after World War II with the proviso that it stay open as an airport forever. And, Santa Monica signed on at that. So, boy, you'd think something like that would stick. So the FAA was expected to take it to court, you know, arguing that they'd agreed that it would stay an airport forever, but somehow they decided not to. So we're all kind of scratching our heads as to what happened here.
Yeah, now the land developers can develop that property, build a whole bunch of buildings, and in the meantime, the city's making a big push to take over airport services. And I personally believe what's going to happen there is they're going to raise the price of fuel. They're going to cut back on the quantity of people actually servicing the aircraft to make it as difficult as possible for all the GA aircraft there to be serviced. And as a result of poor service, they'll want to move out even sooner. And yeah, That'll just bolster the city's or accelerate the city's closure, because they're going to say, look, there aren't any aircraft here. Why are we keeping it open?
Yep. Did you see the LA Times article over the weekend, Brian, down there?
Yeah, I did.
Did you see the city said, oh, we're going to turn it into a park? Yeah, right. Yeah,
that's such a bunch of crap.
Well, it's already it. I mean, there's that little park right on the south end of the runway.
And, yeah, it's an air park.
It's even a doggy park, which is kind of nice, but nobody. Yeah, I think we've heard that let's turn it into a park thing out here in Chicago 15 years ago. And for all those of you who do not visit Chicago regularly, I can tell you that the area that used to be Chicago Meg's is just a big sort of open, grassy walking path.
Isn't that
and
a
nothing
park?
Else. No, it's not really even categorized as a park. It's just a walking field, and that's all it is.
Huh. So shortening the runway at Santa Monica to 3,500 feet, Rob, as I recall from your article in Flying, you could land the Eclipse 550 on that shorter runway.
That's true. The Eclipse would get in there. I don't think that's long enough, though, for even the phenoms. Maybe some of the really daring citation guys, the CJ guys, might try it. But I think essentially you're going to look at the jets kind of disappear. I mean, there will be certainly single-engine turboprops that can get in and out on that. A King Air could do it if it's not too heavy. But generally, it's going to have its effect, I'm sure, which was to get rid of all those things anyhow.
Yeah, and it really must be disheartening to JetSuite X, which had announced that they were going to start flights out of there, I think, in about a week from there to San Jose and a number of other destinations. This is a membership airline, much like Surf Air, that runs up and down the West Coast. And this will certainly prevent them from taking their jets in there. So that kind of shoots their business plan.
Hmm. All right, let's shift over to a little bit of commercial news for just a minute. This is from Skift.com. For American Airlines, new technology means fewer in-seat screens. Now, American Airlines believes that in-seat entertainment screens are a technology without a future. So rather than install screens in the seats of its Boeing 737 MAX airplanes, American is going to offer passengers free entertainment that they can watch on their mobile phones, their tablets, their laptop computers. This is something that I think I first brought this up, maybe 3 or maybe even more years ago. A lot of people didn't think that this was the way it was going to go. But my argument was always, if everybody's bringing a device onto the plane anyway, why pay to put them in the seat backs? You know, if folks already have them. Brian, do you think this makes sense?
It does from an economic standpoint from the airline. Again, I kind of feel bad for the people that don't have a device. So what are they going to do for the five-hour cross-country flight that the 737 MAX is
quite
capable of
doing? What David says, they're going to look out the window.
And when you're, in the aisle seat and the other person has a window shade pulled down, I think it's unfortunate. I think it's a necessary thing that's going to happen. But again, I just feel bad for the people that don't have a device.
Yeah. I wonder how many of them there are, what percentage of the flying public doesn't get on board with something. But
I think the really old and the really young.
Well, the really old are going to sleep. and they're really young, they sleep.
The trouble is you hope they don't sleep before they get into their seat.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, I'm kidding, guys.
All right. Well, apparently American is planning to give travelers access to a library of movies and television shows, also live TV, and if you buy internet, you'll be able to stream content from Amazon and Netflix, things like that. So that requires fast service, and I guess the new 737 MAX planes going to American have satellite internet from Viasat, which is somewhat faster than the go-go kind of connectivity that they've been used to.
So yeah, can using Skype on an airliner be far behind?
Shouldn't be, yeah. I mean, if you're streaming Netflix, yeah, you ought to be able to do Skype.
Yeah, so one of us ought to be able to be on an airplane doing the show, right?
You do the show.
That's right. That's right.
The thing is, though, at what price? They talk about selling the service. I won't mention the airline, but I was on a cross-country flight not too long ago, and it was $35 for the full 5.5 hours of, you know, internet access on the flight. That's absolutely ridiculous.
That does seem kind of steep.
Yeah, I think I paid $11 a week ago for what was a 4-hour flight.
Yeah. I guess it depends on what you want to do. I mean, if you want to be online, that's one thing, but if you just load up your device with movies and podcasts, other content, you don't really need to be connected. So, I don't know. I don't know what the usage rate is. You know, how many people pay that $11 or that $35 for internet access. I don't know what the percentage is. I'm sure somebody does. All right. We see an item in AvWeb. FAA clarifies ADS-B mandate for non-electrical aircraft. this kind of made me think, non-electrical aircraft. Well, if you're going to run ADS-B, you need electricity. So the ADS-B rule, this is the one that takes effect, I think most people know by now, takes effect January 1st, 2020. And what the FAA said is that if your airplane was originally, well, your aircraft or your airplane was originally certified without an electrical system, then the rule doesn't apply. But what if that same aircraft subsequently had batteries and an electrical starter installed, and the FAA is saying, you don't need it then either? I guess it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, it's making the ADS-B rule consistent with the transponder rule. And when the ADS-B mandate came out, boy, about 3 or 4 years ago, I guess, this was one of those loopholes where everybody kind of said, well, what about us? So finally, FAA has kind of clarified that, yeah, if you're in a Piper Cub, even if you happen to be based at an airport, 5 miles away from a Class Bravo, they were exempted in the past from transponders. Now they're also exempted from the ADS-B. So it's all consistent, which is nice.
Good. All right. Well, we haven't mentioned Donald Trump for a few stories, so jump back. The Palm Beach Post. The Palm Beach aviation head says Trump flight limits will hurt airport. So what does this mean? Well, POTUS, their vacations at his Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach in Florida. And about, maybe about 8 miles away is the Palm Beach County Park Airport, which is also called Lantana Airport, I guess.
It's called Lantana Airport.
Lantana Airport. See, you can tell I've never been there.
Oh, I've been there a number of times. It's a wonderful airport.
Did you fly over Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate?
I've been to Palm Beach a whole bunch of times, and I'm sure at some point somebody kind of said, it's over there when we were driving. No, I don't think we necessarily flew there. I think that's up a little bit closer to the big main Palm Beach or West Palm Beach airport. So, it's just, close enough where it's a problem for both airports. But, this has been a problem ever since they started coming in with these TSAs for presidents, and I don't recall when it was, but it was after 9/11. Wherever the president happens to hang out, for Obama, it was either Chicago or Hawaii. For Bush, it was down in Texas and, other places. It's just really inconvenient for people that have a business at an airport, close to where the president hangs out. I've heard of businesses that have gone out of business because they've lost so much revenue because they can be shut down for days at a time when the president is in residence if that airport happens to be within 10 miles.
And I think that is one of the issues that they're concerned about with Palm Beach is Mr. Trump could very well be spending enormous amounts of time down there.
Oh, it works in Great Britain. Knock it off.
What do you mean
if the Queen's in residence at Windsor, they divert everything around it to go to Heathrow because they don't want to disturb her sleeping pattern.
I think the bigger question is, do we really still need 10 nautical mile circle to protect any president? And I've thought for a long time that this is a little bit bogus. It's ridiculously expansive. Let's shrink the thing down to 5 miles or let's have some more exemptions. But, to shut down all, general aviation traffic within 10 miles of where the president is, to me that goes a little far. And to me, this is apolitical. It's just doesn't matter who the president is. It's just closing up way too much airspace.
What about when the president lands? I certainly remember when President Obama would come here to L.A. It would cause huge disruptions at LAX when he's in San Francisco. Closing down SFO for a while is a bit of an issue. So why not have him land at Moffett Field when he's in San Francisco, or Homestead when he's in Florida?
Yeah, the presidents do sometimes come into Moffett, but not often enough.
Exactly. So, David, is there rules for that or precedent for that? Or it just seems like that would clear up a lot of issues for commercial aviation.
No, it's based on where he needs to go. It does, whatever airport's convenient. I mean, we had Air Force One come into the Grove a lot when it was open because at the time, Bucks County was a place that the president wanted to be. So, now he comes into Philly because there's no base there. So it's, you know, but you should. I mean, the first flight of President Trump was from Andrews to Philadelphia, and he took the seven damn 747. You know, instead of, you know, if it was, she should have taken the C-32. It would have been quicker. But you have a first flight, but it doesn't matter. I mean, it's whatever it's closest to. You know, I don't know how, if he's going to be downtown San Francisco, if it's really more conducive to fly into Moffett.
Well, so look at what Lantana is saying. There's one outfit there, Palm Beach Aircraft. They're estimating that they'll lose $2 million a year based on, you know, the estimated closures for that airport. And another place that I've been to, Palm Beach Flight Training. I've actually rented aircraft there. Great little place. They're saying they could be forced out of business. So this really does have an impact on small businesses, which is kind of sad, especially when, you know, to me, this is just overly expansive protection.
So do we know who defines the, you know, the expanse of the protection? Who says
probably
that?
Probably the Secret Service, I bet. Yep.
That's exactly what I've heard in the past. And I've also heard that they won't budge.
And not to mention the Secret Service has got a nautical presence now at Mar-a-Lago. You know, any of the channels that surround that estate are by Coast Guard. You know, there are actually small boats operating down it. Hmm. So it is what it is. You know, he's going to travel and keep in mind that, you know, he was in Philadelphia. That also involved two C-17s as well as Air Force One, because you have to transport all of the limos and other Secret Service vehicles. So you're not just getting the 747, you're getting multiple C-17s and other accoutrements or the helicopters if they need those, which are accompanied by V-22s. So there's a whole package with the president revolving, and I can understand why the airport's upset, but I didn't think that they weren't going to divert traffic, and I thought that they were working with the airport in reference to that. So I was sort of surprised that this was a big issue.
Depends on which airport you're talking about. So even though Palm Beach International, West Palm International, the commercial airport is inside that inner circle, they still allow commercial flights. It's all the GA flights and all the little airports that are within the circle that get shut down. So this probably won't have a big impact on air carrier traffic. They'll just angle them in a little bit this way or that way. They'll be allowed to pass through the area. It's the little guys that'll get hurt because the airport will get shut down within if it's within 10 miles. All flights will be shut down within 10 miles.
Well, sometimes the airlines cause their own problems. And we saw that again this past week at Delta, where they experienced a computer problem and grounded U.S. domestic flights for 2.5 hours. It seems like another week, another computer problem for an airline.
Oh, these pesky little computers.
I know somebody that works at Delta, and I'll bet he was a busy guy.
Yeah, trying to figure out what's going on. I mean, these things, well, obviously the cost of a disruption like this is enormous, and it doesn't do anything for, the attitude of your customers. Certainly.
Well, no, this is the second time in, 6 or 8 months that Delta's had this issue.
Yeah, and we don't know if it's a repeat of the same issue, correct, or a different issue. I think we don't know right now.
It didn't affect international flights, which was really kind of interesting. It was all domestic.
Yeah.
Exactly the same ground stop they had with United. All the internationals flew. The one difference with the Delta's ground stop, their partner regional airlines were shut down this time as well, whereas for United last week, those were not shut down.
Right.
So, anyway, I guess what happens is, some guy just trips over the power cord in the data center.
It happens.
Oh, it does. It does.
All right. Let's talk about a military story. This is from the U.S. Naval Institute News. The Pentagon wants to review the capabilities and cost of two aircraft, the Lockheed Martin F-35C and the Boeing FA-18 Super Hornet. David, why is the Pentagon looking at these two aircraft?
Because the president asked them to. We all know that the F-35 is the most expensive military acquisition program in history. The Navy is the least happy of all of them with the F-35C, which is, again, we're talking about three different airplanes that look alike and have some commonality. But the F-35C has a larger wing. It has a larger, beefier landing gear, a dual nose wheel compared to a single nose wheel for the other two variants, because it's designed for conventional catapult launches and arresting barrier landings. During the election cycle, the president elect said that the F-35 was way too expensive and we could probably use F-18s instead of F-35s. Well, we now have our Secretary of Defense, Secretary Mattis, and Mad Dog set out a request to look at proposals. Now, there's some confusion on what they're actually looking at. When people say F-18 Super Hornets, they're thinking our standard conventional Super Hornets that we now have in the fleet. That's not necessarily the case. What they're looking for is the advanced F-18F advanced variant, or what was proposed to India, which was the F-18I. It's different. It's a more further advanced version than what we have currently for Super Hornets, the E's and the F's and the G's, the Growlers. The I has conformal fuel tanks that match on the top of the wing. It also has a more efficient AESA radar, actively scanned radar. It also has a weapons pod that has the weapons internally to improve its stealth. Now, we're still comparing apples and oranges. The F-35C is designed, and what the Navy wants most is it is going to be a battlefield node. We talked about the BACN or BACN in the NASA EB-57s as a battlefield node, which means a communication network point for the ships at sea as well as the aircraft in the air flying attack. The F-18 Super Hornet will never be able to do that. So they're looking to see if there's a cost savings or something, which brings us to the next story, which came out of the DOD buzz, that our president tweeted that Lockheed had found a discount of $600 million on our Lot 10 block, which is 90 aircraft across all three services. That's A, B, and C. And it was very nice of them, and he's now happy with the F-35, which isn't necessarily true. The what he's taking credit for was really going to happen, whether he was president or not. We had already come to the conclusion that the about $600 million that Lockheed was going to have, the more we produce these, the cheaper they've become. So there was going to be a $600 million discount on the Lot 10 aircraft, the new low-rate production aircraft over the Lot 9, which are the ones that are just finishing up now. So between that, also General Mattis or Secretary Mattis wanted a review of Boeing's proposal for the future VC-25Cs. They're not Air Force Ones unless the president's on them, but Boeing is looking to reduce costs as well and is working with the Pentagon. There's controversy on what the Air Force says they're going to cost compared to what the Auditor General says it's going to cost. But all of these military programs are not really in any jeopardy. The Navy is going to need F-35Cs. Now, they might buy some F-18s to support that, but the electronics and the advances as far as communication nodes and being able to work with the fleet. The F-35C has no comparable weapons platform. So, yes, it's kind of nice that the president and his staff are looking to reduce costs and trying to convince the federal government to, or the Pentagon to, get better value out of their aircraft. But it was happening anyway. This is just sort of a formality.
Yeah, you mentioned LRIP Lot 10, low rate initial production. I think, David, what a number of people maybe assume, and you know why wouldn't they, is that there's a price for something like an F-35C, and that's what the government pays for it. And you know, throughout the lifetime of the of the program, but that's not at all what happens. What happens is the aircraft are acquired or purchased by the government in lots, and the price per aircraft is different for each lot. And typically for a new program like this, where you're inventing all this new technology for the first time, the initial lots are at a very low production rate, which makes the unit costs high. And you're also, I think, trying to amortize development costs. So you generally see the price, the unit price of each aircraft going down lot by lot by lot. And I guess what you're saying, David, is that that was already expected. And so while maybe the president is kind of hinting around the fact that maybe, you know, he's responsible for this reduction, that's really not true.
No, anytime you purchase a lot of something, it becomes cheaper. And it's one of the reasons why B-2s are so expensive, because we only built 20 of them. You know, if we had built 100 of them like we originally thought of, they would have been a lot cheaper down the line. It's one of those things where we're playing numbers games. I mean, we need to keep the F-30. The Navy really wants a larger fleet of aircraft to support their carriers. Right now, the F-35C is still in the lowest rate production. I mean, so, and they've had some issues. One of the most recent issues was the catapult landing gear was starting to fail on catapults, they discovered. So there might be a rework on that. In the meantime, you have older F-18Cs and Ds that need to... The Marines are desperately trying to find parts for those. And the Navy's F-18s ENFs are getting older. So there might be a stopgap where we're going to purchase F-18s. But in the meantime, you're never going to get a Super Hornet to replace the capabilities of the F-35. And anybody who believes that is nuts.
All right. One last item. From the news, and this is something that Scott Spangler wrote over at Jetwine, Pilots, Aviation, and the Paradox of Progress. Rob, what's the paradox here?
Well, the paradox is essentially that the better the technology, the improvement in safety is all wonderful, but eventually we're putting the men and women that fly airplanes out of a job. And I really, when I read Scott's first draft of this the other day, I was really mad. I said, how can you write about this, you traitor? You know, but unfortunately, I think that is one of the problems that we face in this industry, is that too many people don't want to admit that years ago there used to be five people on an airplane, a pilot, a co-pilot, a captain, a first officer, a navigator, a radio operator, a flight engineer, and then they started picking them off one by one by one. And now they're just two, and there aren't too many people around that don't believe that it's going to eventually end up as one. And if you can have one in the front running the technology or monitoring the technology, why can't you have that person on the ground? And so if you guys think Scott is nuts, please go over there and tell him. Unfortunately, I think he's probably on the right track, and that's what I thought was so interesting about it.
I do too, actually. And this is a topic that's been coming up more and more in tech circles, as we see, you know, automation, machine learning, artificial intelligence, big data, all this stuff going on, is that the things are getting automated. We require fewer and fewer people. And there are actually some, to put a political cap on this, there are some who are actually starting to say that some of the perspectives, let's say, of large portions of the population are, because of this transition, from the industrial economy to an information economy, and, you know, the old structures don't work very well. And people have compared it to the transition from the agrarian economy to the industrial economy. And, you know, some people would say that that's one of the contributors to, like the Civil War that we had. I think these things really do impact aviation, not only the pilots, but, you know, also all the support professions at the airport, at the companies that manufacture the service aviation. I think it kind of spans all those things.
Well, and certainly we're just talking about our industry, but of course it is also going to begin, if it hasn't, start affecting other industries. I mean, look at a TV studio. I mean, how many times in the old days you used to see two or three people behind the cameras moving them around, and you still see that maybe on Saturday Night Live. But there are also new studios that have robotic cameras that move on their own from the control room. And so it's a couple of jobs here, a couple of jobs there. And then someone says, well, you know, if we can do without people here, I'll bet we could automate this thing.
Yep.
And so it's, again, is it something we can stop? Probably not. And the question is, what are we going to do?
That's a really good analogy. I used to work for a CBS many, many moons ago, and you go into the control room during an evening newscast, and man, it was a beehive of activity, half a dozen people yelling and screaming, you know, probably three people on the floor, one on each camera, the floor director who was out there, you know, giving instructions to everybody. You look at our local NBC affiliate here, and I've seen it where there's just one person in the control room, period. Nobody in the cameras. It's really stunning. So, yeah, I just listened to a podcast over the weekend talking about somebody who had worked for a GE locomotive for years, and they've been laid off. Well, gosh, you know, you kind of expect there are fewer locomotives being built these days, so it's no wonder.
And it's all fine and great until the computers break.
Yeah, just ask Delta.
That's true.
And United.
Well, I think anybody that reads the story that Scott wrote should give him hell and tell him that it was really a bad story because it made me cry on the Airplane Geeks. go get him.
All right, let's talk about what's up with the geeks. Let's see, Brian, let's start with you. Anything you'd like to talk about?
So Max Trescott turned me onto a podcast, and it's one from Gimlet Media. It's called Reply All, and they came up with a thing that they wanted to do on April 30th, or they actually did it last year on April 30th, and it's Email Debt Forgiveness Day. And I bring this up because I think I'm going to turn every day into an email forgiveness day, because right now in my personal account, I'm sitting with 1,091 unread emails. In my Airplane Geeks account, I have 1,390 emails.
Yikes.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
And Brian, we forgive you.
No, but how do you do that?
How do I get so far behind?
Yes.
I travel a lot, and I change, and my work computer changed, so I didn't have access to email for a little bit. And it's easy. You put it off one email at a time, and they just kind of pile up after a while. And it's driving me crazy, because normally I run with a zero email in my inbox. That's normally how I work. So this is making me crazy. So I bring this up because what I'm going to do to solve this problem, because I'm a completist, I have to read all of these emails and respond to them where necessary. But instead of putting together a thoughtful response, chances are you're only going to get a one-word answer, such as yes, no, thanks, something like that, just so I could get through my email and make it a manageable size. So that's kind of my goal.
All right. Well, good luck, Brian. I guess the message for Airplane Geeks listeners who've written to you is just be patient, I guess.
Exactly. That's the other thing I wanted to mention.
All right. Max West, what's going on in your world?
Well, I'm changing my whole way of communicating with Brian. I'm pulling out some envelopes and stamps.
It'll be faster.
Oh, dear. Well, maybe that Hyperloop thing we're testing here in California will work. You know, I'll just stick the letter in the slot, and it'll go down the tube, and you'll have it there 20 seconds later.
How 1930-ish of you.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Well, let's see. I interacted with a listener this past week. So Bruce Dickerson and his wife, Kathy, were in town. He was here on business. He contacted me and said, hey, I want to go flying when I'm out there. And he flies Bonanza back in the Atlanta suburban area. So we had a lot of fun. We flew in his first flight in a Cirrus, rented here from a local club that I teach at. Did the Bay Tour, flew along the coast of California, along the cliffs there, and over the Golden Gate Bridge and over Alcatraz, and flew right next to SFO at 1,500 feet, which was amazing because we watched an A380 from Lufthansa take off right in front of us.
Nice. So,
and of course, the tower guy said, caution, wake turbulence.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. And it worked out well that he was, the A380 was climbing out. And so the area where we passed his wake, we were above where he had been. We certainly didn't want to be below where he had been, since wake turbulence tends to sink over time. So anyway, just wanted to do a quick shout out to Bruce and tell him I had fun with him and glad he enjoyed his flight here in San Francisco.
Cool. Rob, anything of note?
Well, let's see. This weekend I had oodles of fun. On Saturday I was representing our local airport at a 99's training event. We had up on the northwest suburbs of Chicago. And for those of you that may not know, the 99s is the International Ladies Pilots Association. And so there are lots of people from all over Chicagoland. And I met some people who were thinking about learning to fly. I met a really interesting young lady who talked about being an air traffic controller. And I said, oh, well, where do you work? And she said, oh, I work at the O'Hare Tracon. And I went, oh, wow, that's pretty cool. And you know, I said, well, gee, where? Because in traditionally, I mean, you would never go to O'Hare until you had worked at a, you know, probably a VFR tower or a smaller radar facility. And I said, you know, so where were you before? And she said, nowhere. This was the first place I ever worked. And I said, holy smokes, to go from never having been an air traffic controller to going to vectoring traffic at the IFR room at O'Hare is pretty amazing. To me. So I was really impressed. But another thing that happened to me is I'm sitting at the table and this fellow with silvery hair, kind of he was an old guy, actually. And he walks up to the table and just kind of stares at me and smiles. You know, one of those smiles like, I know you. And I'm looking at this guy and I'm going, oh, man. I know you. Wait. I said, oh, my God. I said, are you Paul? He went, yeah. And I realized it was a guy who used to fly with it Midway, God, 25 years ago. And I hadn't seen him in all these years. And it was really funny that he said, I can't believe you remembered my name. And I said, I can't believe I remembered your name either. So, but it was a lot of fun to run into people I hadn't seen in a long time and do some good work out there trying to promote GA. So I always encourage people, if you can do something like that and volunteer an afternoon of your time, I think it really makes a difference for those people that don't have near the experience that we do, to be able to talk to people who have more experience.
Yeah, yeah. Very good. All right, David, anything?
No, I'm good.
Okay.
All right. Wait a minute.
Wait a minute?
Yeah. Come on, David. Come on. Talk about what we were talking about today. Come on.
What were we talking about today?
From Airfax.
Oh, well, but I haven't done anything about
that. Oh, I know, but I just think it's an interesting opportunity we should mention.
Well, then go right ahead.
Okay. I'm trying to let you have a little airtime there, but we had a interesting note that came across a couple days ago that Airfax Journal, which was originally a print magazine, I don't know, 75 years ago or 80 years ago or whatever, is online now. In fact, John Zimmerman, who we've had as a guest from Sporty's, is the editor. And they put out a note yesterday that said they are looking for aviation writers, no experience required. Wow. And so if people go up to the Airfax Journal website, which I can't for the life of me imagine what the URL is, you'll just have to figure it out.
Or we'll put it in the show notes.
We'll put it in the show notes. So if you've ever had a thought about writing, you know, and last week we had Steve Pope on from Flying Magazine, and he said, I get to keep my job despite how you guys treated him. So I think I was pretty impressed with that. And so there is always that opportunity. Everybody's looking. So go get them.
Wow. Cool. I love those kind of opportunities when they come up. All right. Well, I can report that myself and Drone Mama, we went and watched Hidden Figures. That's that new movie about...
Wait a minute. Drone Mama?
Yeah. You know,
I never heard that.
Well, you should listen to our other show.
I was going to say, you do listen to the other show, right?
Occasionally. I've just never heard the Drone Mama thing.
Or what about this show where she's been mentioned that way?
I'm sorry. I just never heard that. Sorry, guys. Okay.
So, Rob, as you get older, what's the first thing to go? That's what I want to know.
Yeah.
That, too.
We watched Hidden Figures, right? That's that new movie about Katherine Johnson and Dorothy Vaughan and Mary Jackson, the three African-American women who worked at NASA way back at the beginnings of the U.S. manned space program. And we always sit through the credits at the end because we just like to read the credits. And we saw our friend NASA historian Bill Berry show up in the credits not once but twice. So I contacted Bill to tell him that, you know, how exciting it was to see his name up there on the screen, but also to kind of see if I could poke him a little bit into commenting on the historical accuracy of the movie, recognizing that these things are almost always fictionalized a little bit anyway. But it turns out that the screenplay writers, Schroeder and Melfi, they took, he said, a lot of liberties with the timeline. But they really did put a lot of effort into making sure that the movie was true to the experience of those three women. And in fact, they consulted with him quite frequently. Bill and the writers had some back and forth over different elements of the script. And Bill says that, well, it's not a documentary, but it is an excellent movie, and he thinks that's just great. So highly recommend it if you haven't watched Hidden Figures yet.
And it won the award last night, the Screen Actors Guild Award for Best Ensemble Movie.
That's right. Yes, it did. So it's pretty cool. Yeah, when you see a movie like that, especially one that you like, it's always nice that, you know, at least it's pretty accurate. Sometimes you find out later that it has nothing to do with reality, but that's not the case here.
But you know, something you mentioned that's really important, I think, is staying for the credits.
Yeah.
I never used to do that myself, but now having a daughter who's about to graduate with a film degree, she religiously makes me sit there and watch the credits. And it's amazing the little bits and pieces of sort of production knowledge that you pick up, such as, I didn't know that's where that was filmed, or, oh, that's whose music that was, or, oh, that's that guy. You know, If you're a film geek, I think that kind of thing's important.
Yes, absolutely. And if you're even if you're not so much a film geek, but like you say, Rob, you do pick up a lot of interesting little tidbits, and it's interesting to see. Sometimes you start to recognize names even and production companies and things like that. So anyway, great movie.
And just a small regional difference. I know that Brian knows this. Years ago, I went to a movie down in L.A. with my wife, and it was just the darndest thing. The movie ended. Nobody got up. 100% of the people sat there and watched the credits. And I just realized, oh, you know, it's Hollywood. It's everybody knows somebody in the business, so nobody gets up. That's the way it is, right, Brian?
Yeah, absolutely.
Our main man, Micah, sent in a question. He actually sent in a recorded question. And Micah was asking the question about glass cockpit versus steam gauges. And what's the advantage of a glass cockpit over steam gauges?
So back on episode 431, titled The Seattle Aerospace Scene, Max Trescott requested questions for the geeks for the first episode of the new year. Not wishing to let Max down, I do have a question. For him, in fact. Although Rob may want to chime in, too. But doesn't he always? As far as airplane geekery goes, I am least informed about general aviation. I love to fly that way, and as you may know, have some experience in the right seat of some Cessnas and a one-time flight in a Beechcraft-detailed Bonanza. Now, when I'm in the right seat of these aircraft and they're equipped with steam gauges, I can read them all and know what's going on. When it's a glass cockpit, however, and typically when it's a glass cockpit, it's a Garmin G1000, well, I'm totally lost. It just doesn't seem natural to me, and I have no idea what the aircraft is trying to tell me. You see, I think I have an analog mind. What makes me say this? Well, when I'm driving, I glance at the speedometer. I'm not looking at numbers. I just look at the dial and get a good general indication of whether I need to speed up or slow down based on where the needle is on the gauge. The same can be said for my in-dash engine temperature gauge and fuel level indicator. I look at the needle on the gauge and just know where I am without having to think or compute numbers. This allows me to keep my eyes on the road, or in aircraft terminology, my head on a swivel. Eyes outside the cockpit and on the horizon. Although fewer and fewer people do these days, I still wear a wristwatch, and I've worn one since the fifth grade when my dad gave me his old Timex self-winding watch. Yeah, back then it was called self-winding and not automatic, as they're referred to these days. Anyway, I still wear a watch, and always one with a face and hands, not a digital watch. When I glance at my wrist, I can get a sense of the time without seeing numbers, or translating specific numerals into a time of day in my head. This actually got me into trouble once at work. When I was doing the overnight shift at a group home for girls, one morning one of the residents came downstairs and fixed herself breakfast. She was 14 or 15 years old and asked me what time it was so she could get ready for the school bus. I casually glanced at my watch and said, "It's 6:45. She looked at me funny and asked again, "What time is it?" I double-checked my watch and said, "It's 6:45. She then asked me again, and growing a bit frustrated, I said, "It's about a minute later than the first time you asked me." The poor girl started crying. I asked her what was wrong and she said, "Why won't you tell me what time it is?" I told her that I had when she said, "I don't understand." Her tears started to subside, and I realized that she'd grown up in a world of digital clocks. She didn't know how to tell time, and 6:45 meant nothing to her. I told her it was 6:45 a.m., and that led to a lesson for me, but also one for her as well, as we went on to discuss analog versus digital clocks and what 1/4 of or 1/2 past the hour means. So based on all of that, I have a question about glass cockpits and the Garmin G1000. And to my good fortune, Max Trescott wrote the book on the Garmin G1000. Now wait a minute. When I say Max wrote the book on the Garmin G1000, I mean he literally wrote the book on the Garmin G1000. It's called Max Trescott's G1000 Glass Cockpit Handbook, and it's in its 5th edition now. So I figured I would ask him the 2 questions I have. The first, what's the advantage of a glass cockpit, or the G1000, over old steam gauges? My cousin, who's a private pilot, prefers steam gauges, but can't seem to explain why. Could it be the glance and understanding thing that I spoke of earlier? And yes, Rob, My cousin's still shopping for an aircraft of his own and wants one with both steam gauges and a G-1000. The second question is this. Are there other glass cockpits in small GA aircraft other than the G-1000? I believe Garmin made other models. What are those models, and what are the big differences? Additionally, if you know one of those Garmin glass cockpits, will you be able to easily understand and use the others? So, Mr. Trescott, you asked for it. I hope you don't mind answering my ignorant questions. Please keep it in simple terms for those such as myself with analog minds. Thanks so much. For the Airplane Geeks here in Portland, Maine, this is your main man, Micah.
Sure, I would say a couple of different things. Probably the big thing is a great increase in both positional awareness and situational awareness. So with a glass cockpit, you really know exactly where you are all the time, and you know a lot about what's going on around you, and those things can be extremely helpful. Most of the glass cockpits also are better equipped with some safety devices like traffic systems and terrain awareness systems, online weather where you can get satellite weather downloaded into the cockpit. So you really have a lot more information available to you. And then if you just kind of look at it from an ergonomic standpoint, it is actually easier to sweep your eyes across the instruments and kind of take in the picture of what the situation of the aircraft is from a flight instrument standpoint, just because of the layout of the instruments, which was designed by NASA back in the early 90s, and most of the manufacturers are pretty much standardized on it. They did a really great job of designing layout placement of instruments so that you can really just glance at them and suck in all the information instantly. If you have to look at round gauges, it takes a lot more time. It's it's more work on the eyes as your eyes kind of jump around and refocus on the different round gauges to bring in the information. And so NASA did a study on the accident rate, and they compared glass cockpit aircraft with identical non-glass cockpit aircraft. And what they concluded was that the accident rate was identical, but that the glass cockpit aircraft were being used for a different kind of mission profile. On average, the round gauge airplanes were flying about 25 miles away. On average, the glass planes were flying about 100 miles away. And the glass were more likely to be used for IFR. So if you figure the aircraft were going further away and on a more difficult mission, but still had the same accident rate, that says to me that glass cockpit aircraft are safer. You know, they're doing something harder with the same accident rate. So, yeah, I think statistically they are safer.
Now, Max, we always hear about the Garmin G1000, but do they own that market? Are there other glass cockpit competitors?
Yeah, interesting you mentioned that. So Avedine came out with their glass cockpit about a year before Garmin did. But in every case where a manufacturer offered both suites of glass cockpits, the Garmin won about 95-1. I saw this happen at Diamond. I saw this happen, I can't remember the other company. But if they offered both, people just, boom, 100% of the orders went for the Garmin. So yeah, they very much dominate that space. Years ago, King Bendix was the big player in GA avionics, and they really are a shadow of their former self. They've kind of lost most of the market share, unfortunately. Yeah, unfortunately for them, to Garmin and to some extent Avedine.
Interesting. All right, thanks for that. We have some listener feedback. Some good topics to discuss. First off, we'll start with an item from Fabian. He writes us and says, I'm a 23-year-old aerospace engineering and ATPL student from Germany. He said, I started listening to your show around 10 months ago after having listened to the Airline Pilot Guy show for a couple of months. He says, this is audio feedback, we'll play this in just a second, is regarding Micah's piece on the death of Gene Cernan. Fabian says he disagrees with him on the point that NASA is in its darkest time. Thanks for doing this amazing podcast. I love listening every week. Keep up the good work. So let's listen to Fabian.
Dear Airplane Geeks, my name is Fabian. I'm a 23-year-old aerospace engineering and ATPL student from Germany. You may have heard some of my feedback on Jeff's and the Airline Pilot Guy show. This is my first feedback to you. I've been a listener for approximately 10 months now. My feedback is towards Micah's piece on Gene Cernan's death. It was a great feedback, which I truly enjoyed. Thanks, Micah. But I disagree on your point that it is NASA's darkest time. Yes,
NASA at the moment is not capable of putting humans into space. But what NASA, EASA and Roscosmos have achieved is remarkable. I think putting an International Space Station into space and running it with humans on board for now 17 years, with nations you're not particularly good friends with whom you have been in a major arms race for approximately 50 years, in my opinion, that's the biggest peace mission there ever was. Bringing people from various cultural backgrounds, sometimes even with military backgrounds on all sides, to work on a project in peace and successfully. They set an example that we can work together on an international level and in peace. In this time, with the conflicts in Syria and the Ukraine, and also tension overall on the rise, NASA, EASA and Roscosmos and a few others set an example and proved a point. I think this demonstration of unity on a common goal in a peaceful manner isn't worth a dime less than putting men on the moon.
All right, thanks for that. Micah sent us a little bit of a response. He said, I agree that the global cooperation on the International Space Station is wonderful, but it does not have the same scientific significance nor drive that NASA once exuded. Not that there isn't value to what is being done on the ISS from both a political and scientific point of view, but it's just not what once existed within NASA. He says, a peace mission with the Soviets is nothing new. Previous to the ISS, we had Mir, and before that, the Apollo-Soyuz mission that Deke Slayton flew with Tom Stafford and Vance Brand. With the ISS, we are required to maintain peace as we rely on the Soviets to transport our astronauts, but it's a forced peace more than anything else and is not a new mission. One of my favorite authors, he says, Robert Heinlein, once said, quote, peace is an extension of war by political means, unquote. It's a frightening thought, but it has some basis in fact. The way we make real peace is through true communication and sharing thoughts and ideas as we do here with the Airplane Geeks. Our community may not agree on everything, but we respect one another and truly like one another. Micah says, although I may not completely agree with Fabian, that's fine, as it really doesn't matter whether we fully agree or not. I enjoy sharing thoughts and opinions with him and the rest of our community and think of him as part of my extended Airplane Geeks family as well as a friend. I want to make sure he knows that. Thanks so much for taking the time to write to the Geeks, Fabian, and even more for being a member of our community.
I don't know. I'm kind of in between on this. Micah says that it's their darkest hour. Fabian says that it's not. They've done a lot of great stuff. And it truly is remarkable how much NASA has done along the way. One of the questions I asked when we had Director Charlie Bolden on the show was about the budget. And I was really surprised when he said that they actually got more money than what they were asking for. And with the current administration's proposed budget cut of NASA, I truly believe that NASA's darkest time is about to come. So many programs are going to be cut, and all the great science that they're doing is going to be put on hold through this administration. And I really hope that they'll pick it back up again when the administration changes. But I definitely see a dark time coming for NASA.
Well, we also heard from Bill Berry on this topic as well, and he pointed out that there are a lot of really big things in the pipeline. We have new launch vehicles, new capsule. There's a lot of stuff in the pipeline, and I guess he didn't say this part, but unless there is a cutback of some sort, he makes the point that 2-3 years from now we'll kind of see an acceleration that. May look more like what we've seen in the past. But so I guess with, in this area as well as many others, we'll have to see where the administration goes. Let's move on. We got an email from Peter. He says that nominations for the 2017 Aerospace Media Awards are now open. There's an opportunity to ensure, he said, global industry recognition for the very best in aerospace journalism and publishing. So we'll have a link in the show notes where you can learn more about the awards and the nomination procedures. The awards are made in Paris on June 18th, and the closing date for nominations is Friday, March 24th this year, 2017.
Are we allowed to be nominated?
Well, did you see the categories?
There's a lot of categories.
Yep. And there's not one for great aviation podcast, unfortunately. So I don't don't think we will be in Paris accepting the award on the 18th of June.
Darn.
Not true.
Oh?
There's I'm sorry, I just assumed somebody was gonna jump on that. I was almost positive that I saw an opportunity where something related to social media or something like that was in there. Did I miss that?
Well, some of the categories include things like best young journalist.
Yeah, that's Rob.
Best aviation image, best business aviation submission, best military aviation submission, best international publication, in-depth aviation feature. There are a number of categories that I guess could apply really to any media type.
I think so. I mean, like best international submission.
Yeah.
Hey, we're international.
We sure are.
And you can enter more than one category.
Yeah. All right. Well, so if you're interested in nominating someone, we won't say who, take a look at the link in the show notes. Stephen Tornblum had a little video that he pointed to in our Slack team. This is Foster Brooks. Boy, this is a video from a time gone by. This is comedy. Foster Brooks kind of made a career of playing a drunk 747 pilot. This particular video has got him and Dean Martin. It tells you how old this is. Brooks also did a similar sketch with Ernest Borgnine. So a little bit of historical comedy. I think this is, sort of coming out now because of some of the recent airline pilots that have been caught inebriated, let's say. Back in the 60s, early 70s, I guess, that was a funny thing. Maybe it's not quite so funny these days. But we'll have a link to that video in the show notes. Thanks, Stephen.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't want my pilot to be that inebriated.
No, definitely not. I mean, it is funny on one level, and on another level, it's not funny at all.
Yeah, and I think it's probably related to drunk driving. I don't think people, really thought it was a big deal until, MAD, the Mothers Against Drunk Driving came out probably in the, late 70s, early 80s, and then everybody kind of became aware that, driving drunk is, not very cool. Somehow the whole concept of a drunk pilot, I think, became a little less popular. That being said, it's a funny sketch.
All right, Kevin sent us a link to that Route Happy 2017 Wi-Fi report that we talked about, an episode or two ago. I can't remember exactly, but we didn't have a link to the report. That was in episode 435, so that was 2 weeks ago. We'll have that in the show notes. It gives a lot of great information. It tracks which airlines offer in-flight Wi-Fi as well as availability. It looks at it by quality, coverage, cost, subfleet, cabin, things like that. So there's a lot of information in there. That probably answers the question maybe that I was asking earlier, is how many passengers on a flight typically purchase the Wi-Fi. So we've got that. And we also heard from our friend Jody Bromer. You remember Jody? Jody is the helicopter pilot. And we have a photo of her. She's got a new gig. She just got an upgrade and a new job, she says. She's now an EMS pilot for Air Methods. She says she starts NVG training tomorrow. Is NGV, is that night vision goggles training? Is that what NVG
training
is?
That's it.
Cool. So Jody sent us a picture of her in the copter, and we'll put that in the show notes. Take a look at that. It was great to hear about Jody. Air Methods is a big air medical transport company, one of the larger ones. So that's a great job for Jody. Jonathan sent us an item. This is kind of a good news item or a make you feel warm story, even though it took place in Alaska. And this is about a Delta flight, a Boeing 767-300ER coming from Narita, headed for Portland International Airport. They had an engine problem, had to land. The place to land was in Cold Bay, Alaska. Now, Cold Bay, Alaska, this time of year, has a population of about 50, which was quite a bit smaller than the 221 customers and crew that were on this flight. The good you know, the feel warm story is how the town came out, worked with the pilots, the crew, and the passengers, made everybody feel warm and welcome, entertained them, I guess. Kind of a good news flight. We have an article. It's from the it's from KTVA, a local station up in Alaska. And it also describes sort of the process for now that you've got those passengers in this broken airplane, essentially in this little town in Alaska. What do you do? So they set another airplane to take the passengers, but the 767 needed a replacement engine, so they had to send that up. They chartered a Lockheed L-100 Hercules cargo plane to take the engine up there, but they also needed, you know, the tooling, the engine stands, a crew, a maintenance crew, and all the associated equipment and personnel. There's also an Antonov AN-24 that gets involved in this. So we'll have a link to that article in the show notes too. It's it's kind of an interesting story, and it was great the way the town came out and sort of helped out these people.
Yeah, pretty incredible. Reminded me of the story of all the Canadians, how hospitable they were to everyone during 9/11, during those groundings.
Yes, yes. In fact, I happened to be in Canada on 9/11 in Ottawa, and yeah, the reaction there was, I'll just never forget it. Absolutely. Sam sent us an email. Rob had a good explanation here, I think, but Sam writes that he was on the ground at Dubai Airport waiting for his connecting flight to be pushed back. He says, when I heard a loud explosion followed by a short duration of intense hissing air. Short time later, the pilot informed us that the nose wheel tire had indeed exploded, and we were now waiting for a maintenance team to fix it. My first response was, or reaction to it was, you know, we hear about, maybe less so these days, but tires bursting in the landing process, but not just, you know, sitting at the gate. Rob, you had kind of a good idea as to what this might have been.
Tires on airplanes have, I'm not a mechanic, so I may not use the precise term, but plugs that blow out when the tire gets too warm for whatever reason during a landing in which they were really on the brakes and the tires heat up that way, or possibly sitting around on a ramp where it was, you know, 100 and some degrees. But the plugs blow out specifically so that you don't completely destroy the tire by hot air inside the tire, looking for the weakest spot in the tire and then completely destroying the tire. So when the fuse plugs blow, there's the word I couldn't think of. When the fuse plugs blow, they just let all the air out of the tire. And the thing deflates, but it doesn't completely destroy the tire.
Boy, you don't want to be in the way of that plug when it comes out, I bet.
Oh, no. That would be a very bad place to be.
Now, we have some items from Jet City Star, again, in our Slack team. You may know that there are some significant forest fires down in Chile going on right now. And there are some teams out there trying to deal with it. He sent us a photo or a link to a photo that shows the IL-76 working the fires. But also, we see that the supertanker, so that 747 that we've talked about in the past, is down there as well. And we have some information about that, some photos. There's some videos. There are a couple of aircraft that are also working with the 747, the supertanker. And there's some really interesting video following behind the tanker as it drops its load of, I guess, fire retardant on the fire. Really dramatic. Be sure to look for that in the show notes. Very, very interesting. All right, so I think that's it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. As always, want to thank you so much for listening. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, we have lots of links for you to see. Make sure you check out the picture of Jody in her helicopter. That's at airplanegeeks.com/437. You'll also find on the website links to us on social media, how to contact us by email. There's even a donate button if you'd like to support us financially. Well, let's tell everybody where they can find us online. And we'll start with David Vanderhoof. David, where do folks find you?
You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com. And, of course, you can find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, talking about drones on the UAVDigest.com.
All right, great. And Brian Coleman, well...
Yeah, everyone can send me an email, and it might take me a while to respond to them, but brian@airplanegeeks.com.
Okay, Rob, how about you?
Well, I be talking to the drone mama. oh, sorry, wrong show. That's the other thing, I guess. No, they can find me at Flying Magazine on the newsstands, flyingmag.com, anything that has jet wine in the title, and go tell Scott Spangler his story really upset me.
Okay. All right. And Max Trescott.
Well, if you want to go flying in the Bay Area, look me up on sjflight.com. If you want to follow me on Twitter, please go on out to Twitter and just look for Max, M-A-X, Trescott with a T.
Great. And you can find me on Twitter as well at Max Flight. You can look for me on LinkedIn. As David mentioned, at theuavdigest.com. Also with Mary Kirby at paxexpodcast.com. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. You can find his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at brunomassone.com. So we'll ask that all of you please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Night, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening. We'll be right back.